The book is about two struggling folk singers who are in Boston, Cambridge scene, and they're struggling to make it in the music world. And it was interesting to me to read because I went to college in Boston and Cambridge, and so it mentions a lot of the bars that I used to go to a long time ago. So I'm familiar with a lot of the... anyway, so it's a good local read too, as well as learning about folk music. So, without any further ado, here is Scott.
And any of you who want some coffee or cookies or anything in the middle, just go up and get it. Feel free. And my years playing coffee houses, I'm a great believer. Anybody who feels they need some sugar or caffeine during my performance, I want them to have it. As Terry said, the book Revival, it's actually, the full title is Revival, a Folk Music Novel. And as far as I know, it's the first novel that's entirely set in the folk music world, about two very different songwriters drawn together by their shared passion for the music at very different times in their life. And each kind of mentors the other in some very important ways. In fact, there was a line that was so important to me as a guide for the themes of the book that, although it doesn't appear in the book, I put it on the cover. That line is, "We come of age more than once." And it's very much about these two comings of age that each of the two songwriters has during the process of the book. The older guy is named Nathan Warren. He hosts an open mic and a jam session at a seedy little eccentric neighborhood bar in North Cambridge called Dooley's. And he is a guy who should have been a star, not just, you know, like everybody who starts to play guitar thinks they should be a star. He actually signed a major label deal. He made the album. He was the guy everybody thought was going to be the big star, but the album was never released for reasons that had nothing to do with him or his talent or his music, which destroyed him both personally and professionally. And sadly, that's a story that has happened in real life to many very promising artists. So he's just coming out of years of drinking and depression as the book begins, and he's kind of resigned himself that he just missed, and he's a failure, but at least he's still a musician. And he meets a young, very charismatic, very smart, very talented, great songwriter named Kit Palmer, a young woman who's having what she refers to as her precocious midlife crisis in her late 20s because she doesn't think she needs to figure out what she's going to do and decide she's going to be a songwriter. Problem is, she can't get through an entire song on stage. She has just paralyzing stage fright and nerves and jitters and things. So that brings them together, but as I said, pretty soon I think she's mentoring him more than he is. Give you an idea of the sort of the atmosphere of the book. And because I think of it as a love story within a love story. It's a love story about these two songwriters. But it's also, I was very aware that this world, this very vibrant grassroots music world, had never really been captured in fiction before. So I wanted to kind of take the reader on a tour of that world, and from little bars like Dooley's to big folk festivals like Falcon Ridge and major concert halls and little basement recording studios. There's a very important scene at a coffee house, very much like the One World Coffee House, where I was first contacted to come here, and a scene at a house concert, another very important scene at a house concert. So I really wanted to show the world, the folk world as it exists today, a very vibrant community, grassroots music. So this passage, what I'm going to do is lead up to this song that is mentioned, and then I'll sing the song, and then I'll finish the reading, give you an idea. This gives you kind of an idea of Nathan. Whatever Nathan Warren thinks he's doing, whatever he thinks he's thinking about, he's really always kind of thinking about the music. He's really sort of always inside the music. So Kit Palmer, in addition to being a songwriter, also grew up playing fiddle, and she's playing fiddle at the back room of the jam, and he goes to see how she's doing. This happens very early in the book. Nathan walked down the back hallway, up a short flight of stairs, and into a large rectangular room with something fuzzy on the floor that probably used to be a carpet. There were about 50 people there, divided into several jams, each with a handful of musicians and a few people just listening. Dim overhead lighting cast a yellowish glow on everything, like a lamplit room in an old house. Kit sat with a half dozen jammers at a small table by the far end of the room. They had finished a tune and were laughing and talking in the time-honored way of the jam. Applause is considered bad form because it suggests a performance atmosphere. So after a tune, there's a period of idle chatter, sipping beers, laughing, and shuffling chairs until somebody begins another tune. There is an unspoken order to all this, but nobody really knows what it is. It's simply the way it's always been, since the first caveman noticed his neighbor beating on a rock, wandered over and said, "Hey, I got a stick too." A young guitarist in a faded Boston Celtics jersey, neatly trimmed beard stubble and Martin guitar baseball cap, suddenly began to sing a traditional cowboy song, Colorado Trail. Nathan walked closer, putting a finger over his lips when a few people started to say hi. He wanted to listen. Eyes like a morning star, cheeks like a rose, Laura was a pretty girl, everybody knows. Weep all ye falling rains, wail winds wail, all along, along, along the Colorado Trail. Ride through the lonely night, ride through the day, keep that herd moving on its way. Weep all ye falling rains, well winds wail, all along, along, along the Colorado Trail. Ride through the stormy night, dark is the sky, wish I'd stayed in Abilene, where it's mighty warm and dry. Weep all ye falling rains, well winds wail, all along, along, along the Colorado Trail. Face like a prairie flower, laughing all the day, hear the slow padding of horses and cattle in the easy gait of the song. It vaguely tells a story about a pretty girl named Laura, whom the cowboy loves and misses. But the song never explains who she is or what's happened to her. She's simply gone away. As a young man, that drove Nathan crazy. He tried to learn the song a few times, but without knowing what happened to Laura or even what her relationship was to the cowboy, he didn't know how to approach it. Now he thought those omissions were brilliant, because the song really isn't about Laura or even the lovelorn cowboy. It's simply about being alone in a lonely place and wishing that you weren't. Nathan certainly knew what that felt like. Bobbing his head lightly to the beat, Nathan closed his eyes and wondered what it was about sad songs that appeal to us so much. Do we like being sad? Even the up-tempo songs at the jam were usually about train wrecks, dead mothers, ghastly murders, and ghostly lovers walking these hills in long, black veils. Maybe it's like those actors who say they prefer playing villains because they're more interesting. Our dark feelings have more complex palettes, at least in art they do. But Nathan had learned that form usually follows function in traditional music. Perhaps our unhappy feelings are more in need of examining than our happy ones. Who needs to solve happiness? We need to understand the dark sides of life. That's where the dangers are. Why else would cowboys have sung all those sad love songs? It was the one time they could display their inner selves, explore their feelings, and share them with friends. And those deeper feelings need attention, even on a cattle drive. Leave them alone too long, unexamined and unexpressed, and they fester like an untreated wound. Maybe that's why Colorado Trail leads us away from the particulars about Laura and the cowboy. Laura becomes everybody's absent love, and the cowboy's loneliness becomes everybody's loneliness. And doesn't the simple act of sharing that in a song make us a little less lonely? So as you can see, another thing that I really wanted to do with revival, and this is very much what to me is great about folk music today, I didn't want this just to be a book about the music business, about people being stars or not being stars, as if that was the sum of the reason that music exists, that humans invented music. I wanted it to be a book about the love of music that we all have and what it is about music that can, you know, the mystery of listening to a 150-year-old, 180-year-old cowboy song and have it take us so deeply into our own most intimate emotions. From somebody who lived such a very different life than we did. And that, I think, really is one of the saving graces of Nathan in the book, and certainly one of the things that brings Nathan and Kit together, something that they very much share, is this mystical awe of the power of music. And what I mean by saying it's very much what folk music is about today, I think folk music, its mission has always been, I think, to be a real people's music, to be about us. At one point, Nathan reflects that it's sort of the mission of folk music to make, as he puts it, our most ordinary mornings the stuff of song. And it's so different from what pop music is today, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything except buying things. But even though this is very much a contemporary novel, I couldn't resist, as I was saying to some of you earlier, after covering folk music for so long and being in it for so long, there are these stories that a lot of them were great stories that I would hear after interviews that I couldn't slip into the stories, you know, but true stories about folk that say so much about the music, because I think it's the people in folk music, even more than in other music forms, it's the people that really drive it. And so let me share one of those with you about a blues legend from the 1960s. Bless you. For weeks, Nathan had been... Thank you so much for doing it between readings. It's very thoughtful of you. And particularly not during the song. For weeks, Nathan... No, feel free. It's the sounds of real life. It's what folk music is all about. So. For weeks, Nathan had been jotting down his favorite stories about folk music. Not necessarily the most important ones, but the fun ones. The odd, mysterious, and revealing ones. The ones that felt like secrets. There was a story he'd heard about the old Texas blues legend Lightnin' Hopkins. He had a few minor R&B hits in the 40s, right around the time rhythm and blues was getting its name. What Hopkins took away from the experience, more than anything, was that he should never trust a white man with a pen in his hand. And so the story goes, one fine day Lightnin' found his cupboards bare. It was the dawn of the 60s folk revival, and several small record labels had expressed interest in recording him again. He always said no, but now he needed the money. He got in his car and drove to New York, the Big Apple, Gotham, the city so nice they named it twice. Arriving at one of the labels, he told them he would record for them, but he would not sign anything and would not accept a check. Cash only, one payment, and a bottle of gin. Of course, the right thing would have been to say, "Oh, no, Mr. Hopkins, that will cost you a lot of money. Think of the royalties, sir." But the label would get to keep those royalties, So they scurried to the bank and came back with a few $1,000 in a big brown envelope and a bottle of gin. He opened both, put one in his pocket, the other in his mouth, and sang them 12 songs, all in one or two takes. "Everybody happy?" he said when he was through. Everybody nodded, so he left, got in his car, checked his address book, and drove to the next label that had asked about recording it. He made them the same proposition, got the same deal, and, drinking their gin and stuffing their big envelope in his pocket, sang them the same 12 songs. He repeated this process with 5 or 6 other labels over the next few days, then drove home to Houston and restocked his cupboards. Nathan didn't know if the story was true, but he hoped it was. He did know there were a curious number of Lytton and Hopkins records from the early 60s that featured different versions of the same songs. I have, since this book came out, one of the wonderful things about folk music is the audiences that come, the people that you meet, and Gordon Bach, the great Maine folk singer, is convinced that folk audiences collectively know everything that there is to be known, and that if there is anything you want to know, just go on tour, ask 3 or 4 coffee house audiences, somebody in the back will know and come up and tell you. But since this book came out, I've heard from 2 different very reliable sources that that story was true. And it was pretty much the way it was told. So, I also wanted to show, and here maybe get to some of the things that might interest you a little bit as a writer. I wanted to show, I think one of the great advantages of fiction, one of the reasons that I wanted to write a novel about folk music, is that you can get deeper inside the process of being a musician, and deeper inside the not only the wonder of music, but the process of making music, creating arrangements, and writing songs, which of all the art forms I've dabbled in, songwriting is the most dependent on the whims of inspiration. And sometimes you'll hear a songwriter say, it took me 5 years to write this song. It doesn't mean that they spent 5 years writing at it every day. It means that they wrote one verse and were stumped for 2 years. Then they came up with a chorus, and then they were stumped for 2 more years, and just sort of waiting for the song to come. And so I wanted to show that. Nathan thinks that that part of his life is over. He's resigned himself that the creative, artistic fire part of his life is over. But then he meets Kit, and he falls in love, and, you know, all kinds of things come back to life, don't they? So this is how the song comes to him, and sort of shows how he begins to process that. Nathan was sweeping the kitchen floor, humming quietly to the slow swish of the broom. He stopped suddenly, realizing he was remembering the melody to an old unfinished song. He hadn't thought of it in years, but always meant to finish it someday. Why had it come back to him now? He walked into the living room, picked up his guitar, and sang the first 2 lines. Make me well, someone break the spell that's kept me down since first I fell. He sang it again and laughed, remembering the self-pitying lament he'd tried to write after that opening couplet. Pompous young twit. He hadn't even liked the girl who inspired it. He just hadn't liked the idea of her dumping him. It had been nothing but vanity, pure, foolish vanity. No wonder he couldn't finish it. It wasn't true. Maybe that's why it came back to him after all these years. Maybe he'd grown up enough to know what to write after those first 2 lines. He felt a faint tickle of inspiration, the strange feeling that ideas were forming into words in that place beneath our conscious thoughts. He'd always liked the melody and felt it had something to say. There must be some reason it returned to him today, but it had been such a long time since he'd written anything. The old fear flashed through him. What makes you think you can relight the old dead fires of inspiration? Keep them cold. They're safer that way. They can't burn you. But then he thought about Kit during those nor'easters, alone and hurt, wondering what she had done to drive him away and writing that beautiful new song, turning her feelings inward and then outward to the way we all feel when winter makes us seem so alone in the world. He tentatively touched the guitar as if it was something strange and new in his arms. His fingers faltered and fluttered from the strings. He was afraid. It had been so long, so long. But then he realized he was feeling something different, more recent. Not the familiar specters of cold ash and dead ember, the memory of wood. It did not bring the familiar pain, but something that tingled excitedly, expectantly beneath the fear. What was it? He smiled and caught his breath. Oh, that. He realized that his fingers felt on the strings the way they had at the first touch of Kit's soft skin the first time they made love. How his hands had fluttered and faltered on her shoulders and along her arms and back. And how she'd smiled at him, warmly, safely, and leaned into his hands until they found their firmness. He closed his eyes, keeping that smile inside him, and began to play. He pressed his fingers down until the old sureness returned. And then after he writes for a little while, I don't always share this, but since there's so many writers here, because I think the writers will relate to this, he says, it's one of the hardest things for the songwriter to do and the most important, completely useless discipline for a journalist at working at a daily newspaper, I can tell you. And that is knowing when you're starting to hurt it, knowing when you have to stop, and you have to let it incubate, you have to let it breathe, you know, and leave it until it calls you back. Is that enough for today? Let it breathe a while, incubate. It's an amazing thing about songs. You can leave them alone, then return to find that they've made progress on their own, like they're living things. And then suddenly they seem to have their own energy. Nathan used to call it the Pinocchio moment, when the piece of wood comes to life. From that moment on, a song participates in its own creation. That's when you know you've got a real song, and you know it viscerally. It's euphoric, like the best rush from the best drug in God's own pharmacy. And another point, he has a line just come to him, just charged through him like an electric shock. And he doesn't even know if he wrote it, if it came so fully formed, and at the end he's just enjoying the feeling, because it's like I'm sure some of you have had it, this, it's like a physical sensation, like sort of like the way you feel after an electric shock, this kind of mixture of ache and elation that something has physically passed through you. And that passage ends with nobody knows where these things come from or how they happen. The ancients used to call it the muse because they didn't know what the hell it was either. Does anybody have anything that they want to ask or add? Or I want to feel free to make this as conversational as what? Yeah.
I find myself wondering, because I don't know the exact time frame of the novel, mm-hmm. Where Bob Dylan is in this. Is he a meteor who starts out with Woody Guthrie songs and becomes this extremely popular creative genius? Is he mm-hmm. outside the realm of the story arc?
Well, he's not in the book. I mean, it's a novel. So.
Well, I know, yeah. I know. But is he part of the general atmosphere of folk?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. He isn't not in the novel so much, but Woody Guthrie, actually, there's a very important scene you sort of consider the different things that the older Nathan Warren and the young Kit Palmer, that they draw very different things from Woody. Mm-hmm. That he's always been very struck by Woody's outspoken radicalism and his ability to articulate that poetically. She's very drawn by how intimately he experiences everything he talks about. Mm-hmm. And she looks at him and sort of wrinkles her nose like it might be the wrong answer, you know, and she says it almost feels like they're all love songs. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that she's right and that he's never really thought about it, but that's his real power, is that he humanized everything so much and he made it also human. But Dylan very much took from that, from the Woody Guthrie tradition. And when, in fact, when he first got to Greenwich Village, years later, he described himself as being a Woody Guthrie jukebox.
Yeah.
And he, I mean, it wasn't just, the songs. It was the hair, the dress, the mannerisms. He held his cigarettes the same way that Woody did in pictures. He ingratiated himself into Woody's hotel or hospital room, and,
right.
and then went to Greenwich Village and said he was an old friend of Woody's that was just into town stuff. But he's very much a part of he's the link in that tradition going forward. Yeah,
I guess I'm wondering if the older generation is of the '60s, and if the meeting time with the younger generation is past the '60s. Is your novel placed in a particular decade?
It's contemporary, but it's sort of, I don't know if there's a literary, maybe somebody here knows if there's a literary term for when you set up sort of a permanent contemporary state, so that it's contemporary now, and hopefully in 20 years somebody will pick it up and still feel it's a contemporary novel. And this goes backwards with this too. I was talking to some people earlier that there are people from whose experience with open mics and jam sessions and folk music on that level was in the 80s, or the 70s or the 60s, who swear that the book is from that era.
Okay.
There are people who have read the book and absolutely are convinced that it's from the 60s, even though there are cell phones and computers that play pretty important roles in the book.
Yeah.
But they just sort of, you know, the thing that's great about fiction is that your imagination plays such a role, and your memory becomes a co-writer. So
yeah.
People, that's what people see. I mean, one of the nicest things anybody wrote about Tom Paxton, the great songwriter from the '60s, wrote about revival. It very much reminded him of his days starting out in Greenwich Village, and he said, "Really, just shuffle a few tables and chairs around, and you've got it."
Yeah.
So part of that is just that because folk music exists as such a human tradition. I mean, what I see is that, you know, Woody Guthrie picked that tradition up from the people who taught him and from the traditional songs he learned growing up in Okemo, Oklahoma. And Dylan picked that tradition up from Woody, as Pete Seeger did.
Right.
And then other people picked that tradition up from Dylan. I'll tell you a great story that I think is really an example of what tradition means in a human way, not this sort of abstract
yeah.
way, but in a living way. Bill Morrissey, any of you familiar with Bill Morrissey?
Yes.
Great
yeah.
New Hampshire songwriter and novelist who wrote a book in which the main character was called Edson, great book. The main character is a songwriter. But he told me that he went to the Newport Folk Festivals in the early 60s. He just discovered Dylan, and he wanted to be Dylan, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes to the Newport Folk Festival, and he just follows Dylan around. That's all he wants to do is just follow Dylan around. And he gets to this workshop, and he's on the stage with three or four other people. And Bill Morrissey is just staring at Dylan. And then during the song by this old black guy, he realizes that, you know, Dylan has leaned over in his chair, and he's just staring at this guy's hands on the guitar as he sings. And so he looks at that, and his eyes follow that over. He looks back at Dylan. He looks at the old black guy. He looks back at Dylan. And the way Morrissey told the story, he said, "That was my light bulb moment. I said, wait a minute. If I want to sing like that cat, I shouldn't be listening to that cat. I should be listening to that cat. I should be listening to the cat that cat's stealing from." And that guy was Mississippi John Hurt.
Oh, yeah.
So Morrissey immersed himself, and his primary influence as a guitarist and songwriting stylist was Mississippi John Hurt. So that's how the tradition works, always moving backward and forward at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's very much why the book is called Revival. It's an exploration of what revival and tradition are, this evolving sense, both personally and in connection with the music, of what revival means and what tradition means, and that Nathan sees that revival is something that's always happening. It's not something that just occasionally happens. It's the way a tradition breathes. It's always breathing in what's the new air around it, and whatever's sustaining and useful, it ingests, and whatever's wasteful and ephemeral, it exhales and spits out. And generation after generation can look and use that as a benchmark for what's real and lasting in art. You know, because like the folk songs that were turned into folk rock songs in the '60s are still there, And what you look at is you see the ones that sound the most 60s, the arrangements, are the ones that seem the most dated. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. The people who did the songs just straight ahead, those are the ones that last, because the songs always last.
Mm-hmm. For instance, like who? Like...
Well, I think of you know, Joan Baez, early, her early stuff. I mean, it could have been released yesterday. It's when she starts getting into country rock a little bit that her, and into songwriting, that her stuff starts to sound to me a little more dated. And I think, like the Byrds, their versions of traditional songs like John Riley and Wild Mountain Time stand up really well, because as much as they were a rock band, the song always wins. You know, when it's, the song never gets bent to the arrangement. It's always what they're doing within within the song. And I think of all the folk rock bands back then, I think the one that stands up the best is Steel Ice Band, mm-hmm. British band, because they were always just, it was just all about the song, you know. And
it's true, certainly, so many artists. I mean, you look at like Willie Nelson, and his stuff is always fresh.
Yeah.
He goes way back.
Exactly. He's always going back to both his own roots and to the roots of his form and replenishing. John Lennon once said that if he could pass a law, he would, that everybody who makes money playing rock and roll has to sing Bebop-a-Lula at least once every 6 weeks just to remind themselves what business they're in. But, and that was a real guide for me in my writing. Let me do a song here and show you. I mean, I hadn't written fiction before. I wrote Revival. But I'd been a journalist for over 20 years for what was then a very good paper. Don't get me started. And it was a real writer's paper. They really prided themselves on that, which meant that when they edited me, it was for clarity. And every time I got challenged by an editor, I learned more about writing. You know, because it wasn't just, they never challenged me for content or for judgment or anything. It was always, you know, this sentence, I'm assuming you mean it this way, but it could be read this way. Mm-hmm. And so they were always trying to get me to say things in a way that transferred my thought accurately to the reader, and it was all about the reader. And I'd been a songwriter and a student of traditional songs, and it struck me that the two alloys of songwriting with its poetry and music and journalism with its clarity and brevity wasn't a bad combination to create a compound of novel. And I really looked a lot at, well, this song, I happened to be learning when I was trying to figure out how to use landscape and description. And my thoughts about it, what this song taught me, very simple little song from colonial America, from very early America. What it taught me was so important to me that I actually ended up using it in the book. And in fact, it's divided up into two books, book one and book two, and they're both book one and book two are named from lines from this song. The song has the distinction of being so sad that the Irish stole it from us. A rare feather in our cap. Down in some lone hollow, sounds do increase. Farewell, pretty Sarah, I must bid you adieu, and I'll dream of pretty Sarah wherever I go. My love, she won't have me. Does he go to a lone hollow to tell us the story? Why does he want to write the letter by this river? And I just, you know, I thought, I got to figure this out because I'm going to need to know when and why to use description. And I found the most important answers, at least for me, in that song. And the reason is, the term I came up with that really guided me through it, and what I think whoever wrote Pretty Sarah was doing, it's emotional landscaping. He doesn't need to go down to a lone hollow, but he wants, before he tells us his story, he wants to put us into a physical place where we can feel the way he feels, down in some lone hollow. But it's not completely quiet. There's a turbulence to his story, too. So there are birds making noises, and the noise increases. So there's the wildness and the loneliness at the same time. And when you're there, then he wants to tell you this quiet, desolate, turbulent story about this love that, I mean, one of the most pathetic lines in a sad love song you've ever heard. I mean, pathetic in a wonderful way. I mean, my love, she won't have me, and I understand. Oh, man, you're killing me. Stop. You know, be a little pissed off. You know. But it's because this really ultimately underneath it all is this is a song like so many of these love songs from the lower classes back when the class structure defined everything about our lives. It's about class. He is of a lower class and he can never hope to be able to give her what she can give. And at that time, being the choice a woman made of who she married was not only the most important decision, in a very real way, it was the only decision she ever made in her life. You know, like the old song says, hard is the fortune of all womankind, always controlled, always confined, slave to her parents until she is wed, slave to her husband until she is dead. And so that decision, this woman making that decision, you get the sense she probably loves him too, but this guy's got a house. And come February, that's going to be important to me, you know. So then he, at the end of the song, he wants to take us down to this, again, this very lonely place, down by this river, but it's a roaring river, it's a rushing river, because he wants us to feel both the desolation, the sadness, and but also the turbulence of it all. And that really guided me in two ways that I think were really important for using description. One, I tried always to make the description part of the story, rather than a departure from it. Now, I got to say, a lot of very successful novelists don't do that. You know, they set up a scene, they introduce you to Robert Parker does this all the time in the Spencer novels. He'll introduce you to somebody, and then he'll spend a couple of paragraphs describing exactly what the person looks like in ways that I don't think tell you a lot about who he is, necessarily, and that may not end up being important at all because it's just somebody he's interrogating on his... But he does it, and, you know, he did okay. He sold some books, there's no question. He moved some units. So, but for me, because I was, in so many ways, I was thinking of revival as its own piece of music, its own song. I wanted it all to be part of a story. I wanted always to be telling a story and not to depart from that story. And I'll give you some examples of how I use that, that I put together just for you because I knew I was going to be in a room full of writers. So, you know, this book is not entirely about folk music. As you can tell, it's also about these very human issues that confront these two people. The younger character, her, not only her inability to get through a song on stage and this terrible problem she has being who she's capable of being, which I think is a very central problem for all of us in our 20s, just whether it's stage fright or whatever, we are in our heads and our hearts such better people than we're able to show the world until we figure out how to get control of it all. But she also, I think, and this is the thing that I admired about her the most in writing Kit Palmer, was she has this fierce ambition and this equally fierce desire for that ambition not to be self-serving, for it to be used as the fuel to create a life of purpose and of value and of community. And I think it's one of the first things that attracts her to Nathan is that, you know, here's a guy who knows all the secrets she needs to know, and here is a guy who needs a lot of work, not a help. Anyway, Nathan, at a very dangerous point in the book, slips back into this depression, this chronic depression that he's been so comfortable living in. And I wanted to, if any of you have had problems with periodic depression and this kind of depression, and I certainly have it, people write about it as a state of mind, and they write about it in a cause and effect way. But I wanted to write about it very physically, because I think one of the things that people miss about this kind of chronic depression is how seductive it is, how good it feels. And there's a reason people look for reasons to slip back into it. And it, like Nathan even refers to it as his old gray mistress. And as he slips back into it, let me show you how I do it in degrees, but also how I use, it's a nor'easter that brings it up. He awoke the next morning in a warm, woolly funk, which he looked forward to indulging. Just a brood, he thought, a fine wintry brood. He made tea, not coffee. Don't want to get too perky, spoil the exquisite grayness. While the water boiled, he looked outside. Wet smacks of snow still clung to the windows and lined the frames like creamy icing. The yard was high with snow, well over a foot, piling toward the far fence, like it was trying to climb over. It remained cloudy with occasional fierce gusts that blew the snow as if it was still falling. It was white everywhere except for the granite gray of the sky, the walls of the grand old houses down the street, and the stark black of the bare trees. He got his tea and, softly blowing on it, returned to the window. The snow was piled on the panes, always more to the left than the right. He wondered why. Taking his first sip of hot tea, he looked into the yard at the big oak in the sloping yard and beyond to the back fence. The branches on the farther trees looked hazy, almost blurry in the drifting air, but the big oak, the nearest tree, seemed sharply in focus. The effect was like a photograph with the background in soft focus, leading the eye to the foreground. So Nathan looked back at the big oak. The branches seemed lower today, sagging under the weight of the snow. Maybe they just looked that way because only the bottoms of the branches showed under the snow. That's a strong old tree, he thought, nodding and sipping his tea. It's used to wearing a little snow. He saw one small bird on a high branch, huddled close into himself, head darting this way and that. Nowhere else to go. Nowhere warmer, safer, happier. Boy, he knew that feeling, didn't he? The storm is everywhere. The same miserable chill. So there's no sense moving. There's nowhere warmer, safer, happier. Just hunker down. Crawl into yourself. Wait it out. Wait it out. Wait it out. You see him just kind of slipping into it and letting himself fall into it. And then let me do another little passage and then show him kind of snapping out of it. A little after 2 in the morning, with the storm still slapping hard against the windows and walls, he took a hot bath. now listening to the droning 16th century choral music of Giovanni Palestrina. All about God, at least that's what the lyrics say, but so sad, full of knowable human yearning and the long fear that is always there. He unfurled his own comforter, his old comforter, and turned the thermostat down. The chillier the apartment was, the more acutely he felt the captured heat within his baggy clothes. He put Palestrina on so low that it felt more like he was remembering it than hearing it, and went to bed. He slept like he was dead. He awoke heavily. The comforter, full of his own heat, drowned him with a delicious lethargy. Overnight, his solitude had deepened. As he slowly got out of bed, the aloneness filled him, made his ears seem clotted and his eyes cloudy, as if all his senses had thickened and slowed, like almost frozen water. It felt like there was a coat of down inside his head, blanketing his brain with an almost liquid warmth. It was delightful, sensuous, and he knew, deep down, it was dangerous. And that's when he started avoiding Kit. And then just this one other little passage to show I'm kind of snapping on. But do you see what I'm talking about? About how I wanted to show how it's seducing him and he's seducing it. But also using the landscape and the music to create a physical sense of emotional landscape where he is. So I wasn't thinking about, I was really thinking about the reader through all of that. To put him, I wanted the reader to be deep inside Nathan for this. To be feeling what he's feeling and seeing what he's seeing. And I saw through Pretisero how landscape can be used because it evokes all of our memories. It puts us all in a common place to help us do that. Anyway, by Sunday, Nathan knew he was in trouble. He thought about all the years he had spent this way, not just alone, but dug in, entrenched in his aloneness. You don't realize how passive you get. You just start whittling away at your life. You tell yourself you're prioritizing. You don't need this, don't need that. But how can you prioritize when nothing seems important? Because life is no longer something you're doing. It's something that's happening to you. A storm hitting you from all sides. What can you do? People, places, things, events, they have nothing to do with you. And you have nothing to do with them. It's the little details you start to ignore first. The everyday things. And you say you're focusing on the necessary things, but you're not getting to them either. This errand can wait until tomorrow. You don't need to do that chore right now. Instead, you look out the window and ponder how little you have to do with anything in your life. The storm is everywhere. There's no sense moving, nowhere safer, warmer, happier. Hunker down, wait it out, wait it out, wait it out. Nathan looked out the window, remembering what it was like back then when nothing seemed like it was worth doing. God, but I was deep in, he whispered, and got up to make some coffee. He returned to the window, sipping his coffee, and for some reason remembered the day several years ago when he first went out to buy a plant. Something alive in the house, he thought. He couldn't even conceive of it as something else alive in the house. Not yet. But it was a first swing of the hammer against the great gray wall he'd built around himself, and it let in a small but crucial shard of light. Had he known that at the time? No. Well, maybe a little, dimly. Now he saw it with such clarity, his first convincing blow against the comforting dark. Those weak early blows accomplished so much more than they seemed to at the time. They are the mortal wounds to the darkness you are fighting your way out of. The rest simply widen the crack through which your life can pour back in. Those first blows win the war. Only battles follow. So let me do another song, and then I'll do one more true story for you. And then if anybody has anything they want to say, questions, right? As we were talking about Dylan, I'll do it. This is another example of those emotional landscapes. This is one of my favorite Dylan songs, maybe because I grew up in Minnesota. So I know whereof he is singing in this song. That was the first thing. I grew up in Minnesota, so the first thing I had trouble with Dylan, about Dylan with, when I heard his voice, is I can still remember looking at the record that my friend, who was a big Dylan freak, looked at. I mean, I loved his songs, but I'd never heard him sing. And then I heard him, and I listened to about a couple verses, and I said, I thought you said he was from Hibbing. That's not how people from Hibbing talk. Like, they don't talk like this in Hibbing, Minnesota. But then I thought, you know, the whole history of folk music might be very different if in the early 60s a young scruffy-faced lad had clambered on the stage of the smoky Bleecker Street coffee house and begun singing, well, how many rods must a man walk down, eh? They might have just thought he was lost, you know? If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me, the one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. If you're traveling to the snowflake store, where the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm. Keep her from the knowledge. Please see for me if her hair's hanging down, if it rolls and flows all down her breast. Please see for me. My favorite quotes about art from Dylan, and it's surprising coming from him that he would say something this egalitarian, but he said once, I've never thought there was such a thing as a bad song, just different kinds of good ones. Well, let me do another of these true stories here and then just throw it open to anything you folks want or have to say. My favorite quote about writing, this was so useful to me at the Globe.
You just gave it away where you worked.
Oh, no, I did I not say that?
No, you didn't before.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah, I was the folk critic for the Boston Globe for many years. Yeah, that's what I meant about don't get me started on, because it was such a great paper when I was privileged to write for it. Dorothy Parker. Said of writing, she said, to write is not good. To have written is good.
Okay.
This, if I had to pick one all-time favorite true story about folk music, this would be it. It probably won't surprise you who it's about. Fame is a funny duck in the folk world. Folks' notion of fame has always been both larger and smaller than the kind of fame pop culture celebrates. Nathan wanted to explore that because it showed some essential demarcation points between folk and the mainstream music industry. He knew a couple of stories that fit the bill. In the 1970s, Pete Seeger was invited to sing in Barcelona, Spain. Francisco Franco's fascist government, the last of the dictatorships that started World War II, was still in power, but declining. A pro-democracy movement was gaining strength, and to prove it, they invited America's best-known freedom singer to Spain. More than 100,000 people were in the stadium, where rock bands had played all day, but the crowd had come for Seeger. As Pete prepared to go on, government officials handed him a list of songs he was not allowed to sing. Pete studied it mournfully, saying it looked an awful lot like his set list. But they insisted he must not sing any of these songs. Pete took the government's list of banned songs and strolled on stage. He held up the paper and said, "I've been told that I'm not allowed to sing these songs." He grinned at the crowd and said, "So I'll just play the chords. Maybe you know the words." They didn't say anything about you singing. He strummed his banjo to one song after another, and they all sang. 100,000 defiant freedom singers breaking the law with Pete Seeger, filling the stadium with words their government did not want them to hear, words they all knew and had sung together in secret circles for years. What could the government do? Arrest 100,000 singers? It had been beaten by a few banjo chords and the fame of a man whose songs were on the lips of the whole world. Folk is thought of as a fringe music, but what rock star has that kind of fame? Which of the world's great pop stars could have done what Pete Seeger did, knowing that 100,000 people from another country, speaking another language, would know the words to the songs he came to sing for them, and that they would rise and do it in defiance of their government? That is fame.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I heard it from his grandson. His grandson Tao told me. It's one of the ones they told me at the end of an interview. And he said there are all these amazing things that Grandpa's done that nobody knows about because he can't figure out how to tell the story in a way that doesn't make him the star of the story. And he doesn't want to be the star of the story. He wants us to be the star of the story. So he just doesn't tell us about these things. So, does anybody have any questions or anything they want to say? Any?
Did you grow up in a musical family?
Yes. My mother was a very good piano player. Both my grandmother and one of my aunts were professional concert pianists. I never heard them play professionally. And my mother, you know how whatever is going on in your family, you don't think it's odd or unusual. You think whatever's happening in your family is just normal. My mother actually sang folk songs. She had an old guitar that she'd learned how to play in college, and she'd been to a ranch in Montana when she was a little girl and learned some cowboy songs from some of the last of the real cowboys. And on very special nights, she would pull out the guitar and she would sing mostly Anglo-Scottish ballads and cowboy songs, and which still form the core of my repertoire. So that was, yeah. And believe me, inspiring me to become a folk singer was not what she had in mind. And another thing they did, she had Pete Seeger's albums, America's Best Loved Ballads. It was a series he did for Folkways in the 50s when he was convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to cooperate with the House Un-American Activities Committee. Talk about a man ahead of his time. Contempt of Congress? You couldn't find a jury today. but he was a felon through all of the 50s. And, you know, the Weavers were the most popular, his group, the Weavers, was the most popular vocal group in the world. They were the Beatles of 1949, 1950, 1951 until they were blacklisted. So you can really, the commercial folk revival really began in the late 40s and then was crushed by the blacklist, by Joe McCarthy, and then reemerged with another generation who were old enough not to have those Great Depression connections with leftist groups that ruined the careers of so many people. So bands like the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary came up that were untouchable because of those associations, the lack of those associations, and they started singing the Weavers songs at that time. So many of the songs, even Kumbaya, that we think of as 60 songs, were really first popularized by the Weavers in 1949, 1950. Of course, Pete wrote Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and he wrote If I Had a Hammer. But anyway, I had these albums. My mother had these albums. And when my dad would, he was in advertising, when he'd bring people over to entertain, one of the ways that they would bribe me to stay in my room is is they would get me a big bag of candy. They'd let me go up to the corner store and get a big bag of candy. And then they'd let me have the Pete Seeger records in my room. And I could play them on my little stereo. So, I mean, what did they expect? You know, they leave me all alone with Pete Seeger and 3 pounds of sugar. What did they think was going to happen to me? You know? But what I didn't realize until I was an adult, it suddenly one night when I was remembering that, it struck me that they needed to get those records out of the record collection because my dad was having clients over for dinner. So he couldn't have the Pete Seeger records in the record collection. So they were killing two birds with one stone, getting me to stay in my room and getting the Pete Seeger stuff out of the record cup. So even more, you know, they put me in that room with this outlaw music and sugar. And I've never been the same. from the first time, I haven't been fit for useful work since. Anybody else? Any other questions?
Have you read Woody Guthrie's novel, attempted a novel?
No. Is it out now?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know it was out.
Came out 3-4 weeks ago.
Yeah, have you read it?
House of Earth. I tried.
Not very good?
I couldn't get into it. It's a long Dust Bowl talking booze.
Oh.
I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
And on.
Yeah.
And,
that's what he did.
But it doesn't have the brevity and clarity you were referring to earlier.
Yeah.
But it does have a sense of place.
Yeah. Well, you've read Bound for Glory. Yeah, I mean, Bound for Glory is written that way, too. I mean, it's just his musicality, his genius with words is just, interested in the musicality of prose, I'd really recommend Bound for Glory, which is very much storytelling. And it's very tight, vivid prose, but it's got that musicality.
Yeah, this is not tight, but it's vivid but not tight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a connection to Bound for Glory and this Writers' Center and Charles Olson. Do you know that story?
No.
Charles Olson and met Pete at Harvard. Pete was doing tables. And Olson was a fellow there.
He was studying journalism. He always told me that in his interviews.
And he met Olson, and they got along. And then a couple years later, he was walking in the village, and he saw this huge guy, and knew that it was Charles Olson, and invited him to come over to the house there to have dinner.
Yeah.
And I think it was 48. And Woody Guthrie was there.
Mm-hmm.
And Olson and Guthrie got it on and spent a good deal of time talking. And Charles asked him what he was, you know, what he said that he should write down this story that he was telling him. And he was working at a small magazine called The Progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that he'd get it published. Mm-hmm. And that's what Woody did. He got it to Charles Olson. It was published, and that's when the guy at Knopf for one of those big publishing houses saw it, and that became Bound for that became Bound for Glory.
Oh. Ah, I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a connection with Olson here in Gloucester. And this place here, it was Vincent Farini's house, but it's the Writers' Center is sort of dedicated to the poetic investigation that both those guys spent time with.
Well, one of the things Nathan says and ponders in Revival, I actually have it on one of the bookmarks, is it may be a big world, but folk music is a small town. Did you?
I was going to ask you about the similarity of songwriting to writing a novel. Because the way you talk about Kit and Nathan writing songs felt like a lot of descriptions of how people write fiction.
Well, I found songwriting really useful in, just like studying the traditional songs, in things like landscape and physical descriptions. And in a song, you're so limited that you have to, you know, there has to be a purpose, but it's not always a literal purpose. You know, I mean, if Dylan's going to have a snowflake storm in a song, there's got to be a reason for it. And even if it's a reason that's felt more than... I think that's probably where songwriting helped me the most in realizing that fiction, like music, was an emotional language as much as a literal language. Mm-hmm. And it really helped me understand how to write emotionally in ways that, you know, wouldn't be particularly welcomed at the copy desk of the Globe at 5 p.m. at deadline time, you know.
Is it more like poetry? I mean...
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, songwriting certainly is. But I think another thing, and I don't know, some people notice this, others don't, and it's not important that you notice it, but I certainly notice it. There is, to me, a real melody to the prose. There's a real musicality. I don't know if you could sense it in the readings I was doing, but... I was very aware, for example, of the feel of the musical feel of cowboy music when I wrote that passage about Colorado Trail. I don't want people necessarily to hear Colorado Trail, but I think most people will imagine at least the mood and timbre of a cowboy song as they're reading that passage. Let's see how I start the passage with. The easy gait of the cowboy. You know, you could almost hear the slow padding of. And I'm very mindful of, and not in a manipulative way. I mean, I never counted it off like blank verse or anything, but I was aware of the musicality of it. I think I've always tried to be a musical writer that way. That prose, I've always loved the rhythm of the English language. To me, it's a very musical language, and you know, I've always. You know, it's one of the things that draws me to ballads, to songs that tell stories, because they have that in it. But I think songwriting very much helped me with that, with knowing how to write about the emotions and how to surround the reader with things that will pull them into their own memory instead of, you know, another place I depart from a lot of modern fiction writers is that I don't want you to see my picture of Nathan's backyard. I want you to see your picture of it. And I don't want, you know, I think a lot of modern novelists, they feel like their job is to absolutely transmit their photograph of what they're describing to you. They want you to see exactly what they're seeing. And I don't. I want to get you close enough that you'll, and this is the musician in me, that you'll, your memory will kick in. And that's another one of the things I really learned from traditional poetry, that, you know, you think about the songs that are the most visual. You think about, I mean, how little description there was in Pretty Sarah, but how incredibly vivid and transporting it was, because they just give you enough. Down in some lone hollow where the wild birds sing, you can do the rest. You know what a lone hollow looks like. You know what a rushing river looks like. You know, and I think one of the reasons that those songs have such power is that there's such a simplicity and a universality to the imagery, and then they let you do the rest. That was a big part of Woody's genius, I think, is that you wrote the songs with him when he was singing them. You know.
Can you sing one?
Yeah, I will. Sure.
Oh, when when you're writing a relationship, a love relationship between two people who are feeling mutually the same way no matter what is happening between them, how do you avoid redundancy in the picture throughout?
Say that again. I'm not.
I'm not expressing myself.
Be redundant. Be redundant in that, because I didn't quite follow it.
When there are two people that have this really compelling draw toward each other, mm-hmm. no matter what's happening in their relationship, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like that's
yeah.
when he started avoiding a kid and blah 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't because he doesn't love her. It's
right.
because of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Just in the color of the language, how do you avoid redundancy in the language about how they feel about
each
other?
I see. Yeah.
Am I making myself
absolutely?
Clear?
Yeah, yeah. And I think especially with love, it is a great question.
Because it can become really sort of oh, okay. Yeah, we know they love each other.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I think that I think there's three little points. One, that's the perfect example of where the writer's axiom "show don't tell" comes in. You don't talk about how much they love each other and how much they feel for each other. You show them, and not show them whispering sweet nothings, but just show the compatibility in the affection and how they talk to each other and how they are around each other. There's several passages where Nathan marvels at how comfortable he is being quiet with her and that he's never felt that way around a woman before. A big part of what is happening with Nathan is he's been alone for years. So he's falling in love again as a very different human being than he was the last time. But it's a matter of showing and not telling. Another thing is, this is something that the folk songs taught me, and it's something that I think we have a lot of trouble with in literature and in art and just in our lives today, and that is there's nothing more daring than being willing to risk corniness. You know, being just open displays of emotion. And to risk being obvious about that and being corny about that, because that's how real people are around each other. And that leads to the third thing, which helped me a lot through the book. I did some writing about Robert Burns. And I really, really recommend his letters to anybody who wants to learn how to write, because he gets into these wonderful arguments with his publishers who want him to be the poet that he was when he's transformed himself into a folk songwriter, which is always what he wanted to be. So he argues forcefully about the difference between a lyric and a poem, and at the same time attacks the kind of presumptuousness and pretension of that kind of Edwardian poetry. That it was Edwardian when he was going on, wasn't it? A little before Edwardian, I guess, in the 1780s. But one of the things he said that was really just, I'd like it carved in granite somewhere. He said, originality is a coy feature in composition. Love the use of the word coy. And then the example he gives is, we poetical folk, for instance, have been writing about the spring for centuries. But as the spring occurs the same, a certain repetition in phrasing is inevitable. And in other words, don't try to say something about the spring that nobody's said before. Don't try to write about a spring that nobody's ever experienced before. Don't be afraid to write about the things that really excite you about spring, which are corny, corny things, you know. And don't be afraid of being cute, because that's part of the way we are. We become childlike when we're feeling our emotions in an unfiltered way. And don't be afraid of cliche, you know, as long as you're saying it in your own words, because the spring has been occurring the same for centuries. And if you want somebody to climb inside your writing and feel spring, the more you try to be original about it, the likelier you are to push them away, because they know everything that you know about spring.
Reminds me of something else you said. Picasso said, who should I imitate in order to be original?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or Dylan.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And Kerouac said, you don't, it's not what you write, it's how you write it.
Yeah, if you just, I had a great English teacher and who gave me this great, I never went to college, so, which the Globe fortunately never found out. But
now we know.
Yeah. Right. And now that it doesn't matter. One of the things he preached, this English teacher all year long, was not to worry about style. Just worry about clarity. Mm-hmm. And you'll have a style because everybody's unique. So don't try to be stylish. Don't try to find your own way of saying things. Just try to say it as simply and clearly as you can, and you will say it in a way that nobody's ever said it before, because you are yourself. You're unique.
The same thing it applies to singing. I'm a singer, mm-hmm. and when I'm studying, I study with a vocal coach. It's actually more interpretation than anything. And we talk about that all the time, about just sing from your own voice. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter how your voice sounds, and it's very difficult as a singer, something audio, to not, whose rendition of this are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like mm-hmm. when you sang that Dylan song, you sound absolutely nothing like Dylan.
Yeah.
Which is not... Thank you, because it's not that easy to do, especially with Dylan, because he wrote around the way he used vowels and that exaggerated way he used vowels. Yeah, exactly. You know, one thing my father gave me a great tip for that when I was just learning how to sing it. He just couldn't stand hearing me, yeah, yeah, when I was doing a Dylan song. I didn't even know I was doing it. But he said, and this is something I say to singers all the time, if you're not sure about the phrasing of a line, speak it.
Yeah.
Talk it to the chords, accompany it to the chords, but say it in your own voice, and you'll find where within your own speaking voice you can elongate a vowel or truncate a word to fit the melody. You'll find a way to do it within your own natural inflections in your own voice, which you can transpose that same thing to writing pretty easily.
But you do have to know how to do that. I mean, you have to begin somewhere. I mean, you have to know how to draw in order to mm-hmm. to not draw. I mean,
yeah.
You have to learn at the beginning, sort of, a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, and just to me, it's always about just telling a story, and just telling it as simply as you can.
But I thought Dylan didn't feel like he had a good voice. He just said, it's my voice.
Yeah.
I thought when I saw his autobiography, I thought I heard him say that. And he's like, it was my voice.
Yeah, well, it's
and
a very...
I don't necessarily have a good voice, but it's mine.
Yeah.
Mine.
The voice that he built was a very conscious affectation. And he's been very, especially in recent years, he's been... very transparent, very about how deliberate it was. And it was three different parts. Mm-hmm. His singing voice, because he didn't think he did have an interesting voice. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the most poisonous influence to Bob Dylan, I think, has been the notion that to be an artiste, you have to appear interesting. But experience tells me that the more people try to appear interesting, the less likely that they are. But anyway, he built his voice from the beat poets and that very exaggerated way, I went to the store today, and the way that sing-songy kind of way, because he said it made it so clear that it was all about the meaning of the words. And then there was Woody Guthrie and the old-time Appalachian singers, and the way they drawled and were so mysterious when they sang. And then it was Liam Clancy of the Clancy Brothers, who was the finest ballad singer that he'd ever heard, and he's ever heard. And so it was this combination of trying to put to tell a story and to have these affectations that put the focus on the words and that made him seem mysterious. I had the enormous privilege one night of getting really drunk with Liam Clancy. And boy, there's a lot I regret about my drinking days, but I'm glad I was still drinking when Liam got to move. Boy, what a great thing it was. And at one point, I was kind of nervous about asking him, but what the heck, and I asked him how, you know, Dylan always cites him as his primary vocal influence. So I asked Liam how he felt about that, and he said, "Well, you know, I've always been kind of two minds about that." And I said, "Really? How so?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's a great honor. I mean, you know, it's Bobby Dylan, you know, and he says it all the time. He's just, yeah, so what's the other side?" And he said, "Well, Jesus, have you heard the man say?" "Would you want to be taking the blame for that all your life?"
It was almost like, "Okay, you know my voice. You know what you think my voice is. Okay, you try this, sucker."
Yeah. And then he tried, and then every once in a while, for some reason, he would sing something as well as he could, and you'd go, "My God!" Whenever he wants to, he can really sing well. Why would he want to sing?
He was in Boston, and he was just unintelligent.
Yeah. And then he'll turn around and do something, a tribute for Pete or something like that, and he'll sing, and he can sing just beautifully. I mean, you know, as beautifully as he can. But. Well, you asked for another song. Let me. Oh, no. Let me do this. This is about what we were talking about before, about my mom being a folk singer. It's a sort of ode I wrote to her. Settlers who came with their cattle and grain, gold mines, long wagon trains. Ah, but it's still clean out there, she'd say, pure mountain air that blows all your worries away. Sing me home, Carolina moon, home to your big Montana sky. Have your home in the prairie soon. Fare thee well, Caroline. Mm-hmm. went away, but I'd strike it, oh, I'd strike it big someday soon. Said then I'll buy you your home in Montana, just you, my Carolina moon. She kissed me and smiled, said good luck and goodbye, told me she had all she needed. Ah, but now and then I knew that she'd hoped I'd come through to bring her her mom.